We have actually three victims today. We have a council member, Mike Rotkin. Hey, Mike, let me turn up your mic here. Mike for Mike. Okay, go ahead, Joe.
Check test. Hello, Santa Cruz.
And that is Joe Williams of the Santa Cruz Peace Coalition and the Iraqi Action Network.
Mm-hmm.
Ha! I got it right. Plus, of course, Santa Cruz Indie Media. And Mike, what organizations do you wish to tout at this time?
Just so people know who I am, I'm a lecturer at the University in Community Studies and a member of the Santa Cruz City Council.
Okay. And finally, we have the erstwhile timekeeper who has actually gone to jail, or actually to paddy wagon for her beliefs, or police van, if you will. Who are you, madam?
I don't know about the madam part, but my name is Leslie Harrison, mother of two, 13-year resident of Santa Cruz.
And your job is to make sure that none of these guys go over their time. Of course, I've got the cutoff switch here. We're going to be pretty rigorous about this. This is my chance to get back for all those arrests at City Council, Rotkin. We'll see about this. Actually, we can't arrest you, though. It's a pity, but... No, you threatened me with arrest. You called for my arrest on several occasions. No, that's true. So, but the future lies ahead, Mike. So there's always going to be another opportunity for you. And so what's the subject for today's discussion? For those of you who just turned in, today's debate, actually, it's Sam Farr. He's a representative for the 17th Congressional District. He's been at the center of the controversy for some in the peace movement because of his votes in favor of the military appropriation last October, and now, more recently, and commendably in my view, against the supplemental military appropriation, though I think the final vote yesterday was a voice vote in sending this matter to the president, and I don't know how he voted. Does anybody know how Farr voted? I don't. Maybe nobody knows if it's a voice vote.
Do they tally voice votes?
You know,
it's just like
I don't think they.
Acclamation.
That I don't know. I don't know what they do. So maybe if anybody knows about that, as we proceed, we can get some more details. The way this debate is going to happen, each of the two debaters is going to have 3 minutes, and the basic question to begin with is. Sam Farr, bane or boon to the Santa Cruz, I should say, to the peace movement nationally and internationally, but particularly in Santa Cruz. The issue has been Sam Farr's record, and it's a record that stretches back further than just simply this particular Iraqi war. It has to do with Colombia, and it has to do with Kosovo, and it has to do with the uranium-depleted weapons. These issues will probably come in, but the primary issue is the Iraqi war. And how has Sam's position on the Iraqi war been a matter of concern to the Santa Cruz community? So, as I struggle with my usual number of papers here. So, just sort of to rephrase the question, his record on war and peace, past, present, and future, his actions and statements on the Iraqi war, credit or disgrace to the Santa Cruz peace movement, what should the peace movement's reaction to Farr be, and particularly the main motivation for this forum came up in February when the largest ever peace demonstration that I'd seen in Santa Cruz for many moons, 3,000 to 5,000 people, I think somebody even said
7,000.
Yeah, I mean that's what. Yeah, some people said 7,000. No, I would be surprised if it were. I mean that would be great. But at that particular rally, Sam Farr, Mayor Riley attempted to get Sam Farr an opportunity to speak. And the folks who ran the rally said, we hadn't agreed to that, and it didn't happen. And then there was some controversy and an exchange of letters in the paper, and we're going to be talking about that. That's really, but the really key issue is, what should the community's response to Sam Farr be? And that could be a mixed response. It could be negative, it could be positive. That's what we're going to be talking about today. And I guess there'll be some collateral issues coming in, like what should the city council's reaction be to all this? What should our local reaction be to the Iraqi war? In terms of politicians, how should we deal with them? But I guess it covers a broad area, but we're trying to kind of focus on Farr, bane or boon to the peace movement. So your role in this, listener, is if you wish to sit by your phone and give us a call after the first 15 or 20 minutes or so, because each of the speakers is going to have 3 minutes to speak, and then they're going to have another 3 minutes to speak. And I guess what we're going to do is we'll open the lines for a few questions. You get a minute to pose your question, then my timekeeper will cut you off because it's not time for speeches but time for questions. You can do speeches later in the show once Mike and Joe have taken off, or I guess Mike has to leave before Joe does, probably around 11:15, something like that, 11:15. Then, you know, you can have more extended discussion on these subjects. But right now we just want questions. That'll happen, as I said, after the both speakers speak twice. You can also email questions to rnorse@hotmail.com. Again, get a pencil, rnorse@hotmail.com. And if for some reason you don't have a computer and you can't get through on the line because it'll be busy, if you simply call in and somebody else is on the phone because we only have one line, dial the Huff line, 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, and that's for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and you'll be able to leave your message there, and I will then play those messages later in the show, and at least we'll be able to discuss them. I don't know if we'll probably be able to get to them because Mike is going to be on his way. Maybe Joe will stay, and I can pretend to be Mike and maybe speculate. And maybe you can call in, Mike, or something.
I'll be at a meeting, but I'm sure you can sort of say, well, you know, I wonder what Mike would say about that.
Yeah, I can speculate, sure. You can also contact Mike Rotkin at City Council, and you can leave him a message there. Do you want to leave a phone number where messages can be left for you?
Yeah, people can either leave me messages at, the easiest is at home, 423-4209, you also could email me if you have any comments or questions. My email is openup, O-P-E-N-U-P, at UCSC.edu. And that's, I have other emails, but they all eventually dump into that particular account, so you can send it there directly. Again, openup, O-P-E-N-U-P, one word, at UCSC.edu.
Cool. Okay. I guess the first thing to do is to read these two letters, and they kind of speak for themselves and summarize the position of the two positions here. The positions summarize the positions. The positions are summarized. Here is a letter from Joe Williams, that's you, Joe, and Paul Franklin, which was printed in the Santa Cruz Sentinel on March 1st. It reads, "Your February 16th story, Protesters March, Phil Mission Plaza, inaccurately reports that Representative Sam Farr was a speaker at our February 15th peace rally. While Representative Farr attended the rally, he wasn't a speaker. The Santa Cruz Peace Coalition made a decision not to invite him due to his poor voting record. It was perceived that his record these past 10 years too generously supported the U.S. military and various campaigns to render destruction and death upon the citizens of other countries. His vote in April 1999 authorizing the Congress to conduct military air operations and missile strikes against Yugoslavia, ESCON Res 21, is a case in point. During this air campaign, a television station was targeted and destroyed, and the civilians within were killed, reflecting gross disregard for the Geneva Convention on War. His consistent support of several billion U.S. tax dollars to wasteful military appropriations is an example of Sam's tenuous grasp on the value of peaceful diplomacy. In 2001, he received a grade of F in wasteful military spending from a statewide advocacy group. He has supported Plan Colombia, a war on indigenous people disguised as a war on drugs, and NAFTA, an economic tool for institutionalizing violence against the working class in Mexico and the United States. For these reasons and more, we have declined to have Representative Farr speak. Sam's vote against the use of U.S. forces against Iraq, H.J. Res. 114, in October 2002, is certainly a vote in support of the global peace movement, which I and others embrace. An invitation to the podium of our next peace rally is up to him. No to ever larger military budgets, no to Colombia-supported terrorism, move to rescind NAFTA, Plan Puebla, Panama, and the FTAA. We hope it will join us in our efforts to forever silence the guns of empire and extend the hand of peace. Joe Williams and Paul Franklin, Santa Cruz." Michael Rotkin, you then responded, "Twisted logic abounds. Letter to Santa Cruz Sentinel, March 19th, 2003. I was appalled to see the self-righteous letter from two so-called leaders of the Santa Cruz Peace Coalition recently, which they proudly proclaimed their role in prohibiting Congressman Sam Farr from speaking at the recent peace rally in Santa Cruz. These sectarian idiots are not speaking for the 7,000 citizens who are demonstrating their opposition to war with Iraq. A successful peace coalition should be in the business of building the largest, broad-based opposition to the impending war possible. As one of a handful of members of Congress voting in opposition to Bush's drive for a first strike, unilaterally declared war in Iraq, Sam Farr is certainly worthy of our support and admiration. His principled opposition to the USA Patriot Act and willingness to be the first member of the U.S. Congress to attend a town hall meeting about the war also make him a growing leader of the growing anti-peace, the anti-war movement at this point in time. The fact that we may disagree with his position on a number of other issues does not allow us the luxury of trying to write him out of the peace movement. This is the kind of sectarian, holier-than-thou politics which led to our president,
George Bush,
being George Bush, thank you, being George Bush rather than Al Gore, and how Mr. Argue, and I guess this is a response to Steve Argue, who spent most of the last year in jail for punching a police officer, thinks he has the moral standing to criticize Mr. Farr, for Farr's ostensible lack of humanitarianism requires a logic too twisted for me to get my head around. Mike Rotkin. The reason I completed it, Mike, is because I think he may be calling in himself to savage you for that. All right, so I guess Joe, you can get the first shot here. Sam Farr, bane or boon to the peace movement?
Depends on your perspective, I guess. You can see from the first letter you read, which was actually attributed to me and Paul Franklin, there was a few other people who signed on who didn't get their names onto that, so there's a few of us sectarian idiots out there. I would say that if he is showing himself amenable to taking stronger positions, which recent votes seem to indicate that might possibly be the case, then we would take the view, like, my country, right or wrong, you know, when right to be kept right, when wrong to be put right. And I think this is the same kind of attitude we're going to have with our local congressman, considering his very checkered voting record on issues of war and peace. Just to clarify, back when the Peace Coalition, this ultimately Sam was censored or Sam was barred from speaking, what happened was Mayor Riley had called us at the last minute after the speaker list had already been solidified and said, oh, by the way, Sam's going to be coming and speaking. And it's like, well, she had no authority to do that. And so we told her, like, no, he's not. We've already got a tight schedule. And besides, his voting record sucks up to this point. On these issues, which we're hoping to highlight at the rally. So one of our members called Sam Farr's office and informed him of this fact, like, you don't have a spot on the podium, and was proceeded to be read the riot act, so to speak, by one of Sam Farr's staffers. Next thing we know, it's like some kind of big crisis, and I get a phone call from one of our members in tears from the treatment she's received at the hands of Sam Farr's staff. And that just basically solidified it. So we called Mayor Riley back up and said, well, you can say whatever you want. We're not going to pre-screen your comments if you want to laud Sam Farr, and assuming he's going to be there, which is exactly what happened. She used her time to point out Congressman Farr in the audience, and he gave a little wave and whatnot, and so that was the end of that. it's going by really quick. Okay, let's look at it this way. In terms of, like, if we're going to get Sam to take a position that the majority of his constituents want, as evidenced by his office's reporting of letters 101 against the war, against the invasion, against sending troops over there. Was it? I saw 101. But he's close enough. He might be amenable to being pressured on this issue. It doesn't look like he's any kind of a leader on this, and that he has to be pressured by his constituents to, like, do the right thing. Unfortunately, if that's the way, like, representative politics needs to work, then we need to lean on him to take the right position. So he seems somewhat amenable, but we need to keep the pressure on. And at this point, he's following. He's not leading. Done. Oh, I have 10 seconds. Well, at this point, I think we need to continue to pressure Farr to continue to do the right thing. He needs to get more in line with what Kucinich has said.
First of all, thanks for inviting me on the show. I think when it comes to anti-war opposition, there's a sort of two competing impulses that a lot of us face. There's a tendency to sort of, on the one hand, of course, want to build a broad-based anti-war movement to try and get as many people as possible to join our side, to sort of create public opinion that forces the administration to not engage in the war, to get out of the war earlier, depending what stage we're in. There's also a tendency, I think, that's out there, which I refer to in the letter as the sectarian tendency. And first of all, let me apologize to Joe and to Bruce, Paul Franklin, for using the word idiot in the letter. I guess I was overheated at the time, so I do want to apologize for that publicly, but not the content of the letter. The sectarian principle, I think, drives us towards thinking, gee, we understand that this war is part of a bigger picture. The more you study the issue, the more you get involved, the more you realize this is not just some isolated event. It's part of a bad foreign policy. It's tied to a bad set of values in our country in general. Before you know it, you find yourself with a whole worldview that's sort of completely out of step with what the mainstream view is in America. And the tendency is to think, gee, well, I really want to hang out with and feel support for and be connected to the people that see the big picture and see how these things are all interrelated. And everything else being equal, I don't have any objection to people building that kind of an analysis, to push that kind of analysis. I appreciate it when people get up at rallies or in letters or in other places explaining the big picture and how, for example, war with Iraq is not just some isolated incident, but part of a really screwed up foreign policy that we've had, not just recently, but going back probably to the late 1800s in terms of how the U.S. has faced its issues. And unfortunately, when you take that impulse and take the position that a person really is not on our side in an anti-war movement unless they see that big picture, unless they have correct views on all the different aspects of it, then I think what we do is end up defeating what we really need to do, which is build a broad-based movement. And basically excluding people from speaking when they basically are part of a movement or could be part of a movement that we want to try and build, I think is a big mistake politically. War is bad enough, particularly the kind of war we're fighting with Iraq, in terms of the impact on innocent civilians, the impact on our own soldiers, the impact on the world situation, that it's worth stepping back from this kind of sectarian position and arguing that anybody that has strong views against the war ought to be invited. I would have invited and been excited to see the head of the Republican Central Committee speak at that rally if he had expressed an interest in being there and having an anti-war message. So that's the view. Not that Sam Farr is perfect, just that he's against the war. He is our member of Congress, and we should have him there speaking.
Well, and I'd just like to go back to, like, let's take the Republican thing, because that's an interesting thing, because I think part of the Peace Coalition formation in terms of, like, why there's another organization in town and why isn't there we just join the Resource Center for Nonviolence or one of the other existing groups that are out there for peace. And I think it was precisely because of this sectarian-type tendency we have in this town to consider ourselves isolated and holier than thou. So I think the Peace Coalition would welcome Republicans, anti-war Republicans, into the mix. There's no requirement to be a pacifist to be necessarily part of the Peace Coalition. This kind of stuff. So it was concocted with the idea of being as broad-based as we could. In terms of, like, whether Farr is or is not a leader and should be allowed to speak, it's like, well, okay. It's like if he can prove by some votes, and he's got had a couple good ones. Some are iffy, and based on rationale, you have to, like, wonder where his true feelings lie. But once again, given the idea that you can influence your representative no matter who they are, Democrat or Republican, and they are amenable to that influence, the pressure should be kept up no matter what. We shouldn't be, like, slavishly, you know, lauding him with praise for, you know, what most of us in the Peace Coalition consider, like, tepid baby steps towards a position that most of his constituents have staked out a long time before. Also, given the fact that some of his statements, especially like the one recently at the town hall meeting, the most recent town hall meeting that Rachel Dan read, he continually lashes out and talks about the Bush administration and the current and Bush and the executive leadership and all this. What he fails to point out, and what you're probably not going to see, and which is unfortunate, is like most of the Democrats supported this. They voted for everything down the road, supported authorization for us, supported everything. If Sam would stand up and, like, you know, take a stand and berate or hold to account and take to task his fellow Democrats, rather than attack the Bush administration, it gives the appearance of being partisan politics, and he's open to those types of charges because when Clinton was president, there was all this depleted uranium and bombing of civilians in Kosovo and whatnot, and he wasn't anti-war then. He was very pro-war back then. So he's open to charges. He's very open to charges of playing partisan politics. It's when it's a Republican in office, Sam's going to be as anti-war as possible, or as much as he thinks he can, you know, get away with in terms of still having some kind of political play in Washington. But on the other hand, if it's a Democratic administration, who knows where he's going to stand? He's going to, you know, play the Democrat game, perhaps. Time up. 15 more seconds. So the idea is, like, push him as far as possible. You know, yes, thank him for his correct votes, but keep pushing him. It's like there's things that he is not willing to go. Once the war started and once troops were sent, that was, we lost Sam Farr.
In a position which I think would appeal to a broad-based constituency that the war, that there are other alternatives to war in terms of dealing with whatever problems might be perceived with Iraq. Back in last October, well before we were at war, he was one of 130 members of the U.S. Congress And it was a total of 130 out of the 535 members of our Congress who voted against war with Iraq. And again, that was back in October. And I don't pretend that Sam Farr has got to correct politics and everything. As I said in my letter, I disagree with Farr about the issue of Colombia. Probably the two of us that are debating this today have a closer politics around what should be happening internationally than I have with Sam Farr about a lot of these different kinds of issues. But the debate question I'm invited for today, and that it's not just an abstract debate. I think it's a really critical debate about building a political movement, is that we simply cannot afford to hold, in the concept of holding Sam Farr accountable or educating him or pushing him on the issues, not invite him to be part of a coalition. And the word's an important one, a coalition. Basically, as Joe said, the point of an anti-war coalition is to invite all the people who stand together on a particular issue, and particularly when the issue is important as war. There are people there who have strong views that the war is a mistake because they think the United States ought to be attacked. There are people there who, feel strong feelings of patriotism but believe that it's a misguided policy to be involved in a war there. There are pacifists. There are people who, like myself, who are not pacifists but believe that this is a misguided war and will not achieve any possible meaningful results in terms of what we might like to see in the world. If anything, it'll make us more vulnerable to terror and to attacks from people around the planet. So it's not a question of whether Sam Farr has a perfect politics here. It's just that he was outspoken against this war from the beginning. He's been consistently outspoken against it. He's one of the few people, and I'm one of these people that stays up late at night, he's one of the few people who actually gets out in public and has press conferences. I see them on C-SPAN in the middle of the night, being outspoken, talking to the national media against this war and being articulate about what's wrong with it and trying to build a larger constituency against it. So my representation is not that Sam Farr has got great politics on every issue. I disagree with him on many things. I think it's totally appropriate for delegations to visit him in his office to try and move his politics, probably more successfully, not just pushing ideas on him individually, but let's build a constituency in this community that has views about Colombia, which currently does not exist in a large scale. And I believe if the community had stronger views about not being involved in Colombia, then Sam Farr would move to that position. It wouldn't be a problem. But when it comes to having anti-war events, we should be inviting the broadest possible group out to that now to those events and asking that those people be allowed to speak, that they articulate their views. One of the reasons we're able to get 7,000 people, and I believe it was in the upper levels, I was talking to the police about this locally, they thought the numbers were up in the range of 6,500 to 7,000, which is rare, you know. We wouldn't see them on the upper end of an estimate generally, but that's what was happening in this case. This rally was so, it was, and I want to give Joe and other folks who worked on building this thing, you know, kudos for the work they did. It was a broad-based movement, really successful in drawing out large numbers of people. And the issue is, once you get there, you want to try and make sure that the group is powerful, speaks for the community. And Sam Farr's early anti-war positions probably also helped build that movement. The sense that our Congress member thought this war was wrong, was willing to be outspoken about it, showed up in many forms and said as much, I think is the basis for building the anti-war movement. And we should invite everyone who shares our views to come participate in that movement.
It'd be nice to turn up the mic. Sorry, folks. You may have heard that distantly. This is a debate, and I'm thinking, it might be good to have one more go-around, a three-minute go-around, because I think you have raised issues. Do you two feel like another go-around? Let me do it in terms of a question. I'll give you a one-minute question, and you can respond to it. Take 2 minutes to respond. Would that
I can, whatever.
Would you rather do a go-around?
I can do another quick go-around.
All right, let's do a quick go-around, okay? You're up, Joe. 3 minutes.
Okay. Yeah, I might not take all 3 minutes. Let's look at Farr, where he was, where he is now, and where we expect him to be as a constituency in terms of what do we look to in terms of our community as who's taking forward-looking leadership positions on these types of issues. If we look at his record, which I say it's checkered, and people can just look it up for themselves and go to house.gov and like check Farr's votes, it's very out there, accessible to everyone. You'll find that his record on especially war and peace, military issues, as you read in the letter and that we put out to the Sentinel, was cause for alarm by even statewide advocacy organizations. They gave him an F for wasteful military spending. This, to me, is not this is not the type of actions of a leader of the peace movement. And the issue, to me, goes way beyond the current conflict, because we've been in Afghanistan and we're still in Afghanistan. We're in Colombia. We're increasing our presence there. We're in the Philippines. We're increasing our presence there, and now we're having rumblings about going into Syria and Iran. So in terms of like a leadership position, I would hope, and the to me the debate is like, how do we get Sam to take a stronger stand on these issues rather than these little milquetoasty positions? If you read Denis Kucinich's statement on like why he voted no on the military appropriations, you'll get no less than like 8 instances of stop the war now, stop the war now. It's just all over his thing. The war is wrong, it's illegal, yada, yada, yada. Bring the troops home, this is, you know, this is a disaster for our country, etc. A very strong statement. And I would encourage people to if they want something specifically to do, call FAR and have, see if he'll sign on to Kucinich's statement that he made on April 2nd, explaining his vote. And if he won't do it, what are his points of disagreement with Kucinich's statement? And this is the type of thing where Kucinich is coming to town. The Imagine America people are going to bring him to the Civic. And this is the kind of thing, if we had somebody in our district who really represented the actual peace orientations of this community, then Sam would be up on stage, you know, being lauded as the featured speaker. But no, he's taking his reasons for voting against the emergency appropriations bill are very weak. He gave 2 reasons for voting no. And like I said, we congratulate him on his no vote, but you have to look at his reasons behind. And am I running out of time here? 30 seconds, okay. And he says, first, because it leaves our first responders at home, our troops on the home front, without complete protection. So his first reason is that, we don't have any troops here now at home, so we can't protect our paramedics, our police, and our fire department, basically. So that's his first reason, his top main reason. Okay, his second reason is, well, we need to repair our international relationship with the UN and NATO and whatever. That's it. Those are his reasons for voting against the war. This is not good enough.
Again, I don't want to sound like the musician of one note here, but the issue is not whether Sam Farr has got a complete politics that any of us necessarily agree with. I don't have a complete agreement with Farr on many, many issues. Similar situation with Denis Kucinich. Denis Kucinich is not pro-choice. Does that mean that I'm not excited that somebody's speaking out as articulately as Denis Kucinich is against this war? I think it's fantastic that he's taken the strong stands that he has, that he's articulated, and he's particularly good at... I think speaking to working people about why this war doesn't make any sense. There's a lot of blue-collar support for this war, at least the appearance of it, and maybe perhaps because they realize that it's them and their children that are more likely to be fighting this than the intellectuals and academics that lead the anti-war movement often. But Dennis is very, very good at sort of articulating the views that appeal to a broad base of people about this war, and it would be the kind of same sectarian thing that we're talking about here, to sort of say, well, you know, we're not going to let Denis Kucinich in the Civic at Santa Cruz or speak here because, like, we don't agree with his views on... I mean, that's terrible. The guy's not pro-choice. How can you support somebody who's not pro-choice? It's difficult. It puts you in a difficult situation. But I think it's critical that we fight the sectarian principle when it comes to something as critical as a war. It is the big issue that's on the agenda right now. And I think the other things have to become secondary. Sam Farr's reasons being not as fully filled out as they ought to be, his views on war in general are not something that I want to spend time attacking him for in the middle of the fight that we're in right now. I wish he had a stronger anti-military position in general than he does, and I spent a lot of time talking with him about it. It's difficult because, again, correct or not, his perception is that there are a lot of jobs in his district, particularly in Monterey County, that depend upon military expenditures, and trying to provide jobs for his constituents is one of the things that Congress people spend their time on. But that's not a reason. I'm not defending his position. I would still explain that we could find other ways to find jobs for those people. He could become part of a conversion movement that would take these issues on. But in the middle of trying to build a war against Iraq, I think it's not that great an idea to sort of go after somebody or not give him a place to speak in the movement. In general, there are problems, I think, with trying to figure out how we're going to build a broader movement. And I think the real key here is organizing constituencies. It's not a matter of either rewarding or punishing the individual member of Congress, like we're going to let Sam Farr speak or we're not going to let him speak. I think if you want Sam Farr's politics to improve on military stuff, let's build a movement that requires him to have those views. And that's done not, again, by whether he gets to speak at a rally or not, but by whether or not when he goes to speak to Democrats in the district, for example, or constituents generally. He hears from people. He gets letters. People start to tell him in large numbers, as they have about the war, we don't like your position on military spending. We wish you would vote differently on these issues. That'll take some real work on our part to build that kind of a movement. I hope we work together on doing that. But in the meantime, let's not blame Sam Farr for negative views on the war in Iraq when he doesn't have them.
All right. Your time is up, Mike, but we're not going to arrest you for going over by 8 seconds, 4 seconds, actually. We have a caller on the line. Caller, are you there?
Yes.
Speak up.
McGrath.
Hey, Doug.
I was just wondering, you know, they're talking about the cost. I was wondering why there couldn't be an investigation on, you know, the boon that the military companies, the people that make the bombs and everything, and that the oil companies are making so much money off it. It's connected to Bush, his family, everyone that he's appointed to any office.
Doug, you got 20 seconds left to finish your question.
And, God dang it, you made me forget.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You get another 10 seconds?
But anyway, would you just like, you know, the Texas guys ripped off California, I think they're up there ripping off the whole United States now.
So what is your question?
Well, basically, why can't there be an investigation on what's going on? And they're just making money off this. I don't think it...
Okay.
We'll
pose that question, Doug. And if you want to call back and talk more, you can in about an hour.
Because there's none of the
your time is up, though.
Destruction.
Go ahead, Mike.
This is Mike. Actually, just not to bring Sam Farr into everything and make him like wonderful in ways he's not, but as Sam Farr has pointed out, we have a Republican administration that controls all three branches of our government. We used to have something like a balance of power there, and reality is. It is very, very difficult to get the Congress to consider anything. And the kinds of investigations, we could all do investigations of what's going on, and people are doing investigations of what's happened with the Enron issue and everything else, but it's very difficult to get our Congress to take up issues of the clear scandals that the Bush administration's been involved in. And these are not scandals involving sexual peccadilloes or something. This is peccadilloes, whatever the word is. You know, this is... You know, the problem of ripping off the American people for billions of dollars and the rates that we're paying for energy and these other kinds of issues. And there's no question that the caller is correct about this problem. The issue is, how do you get a Congress that is dominated by Republicans to even, like, talk about the question? You can't get the issues even debated in committees, much less on the floor of the House or the Senate itself. So it's an argument here, without getting into a complete sort of partisan debate about politics, it's an argument for thinking seriously about getting people elected to the U.S. Congress who are prepared to take up at least reasonable issues about what's happening to the American people, whether it's about environmental issues, economic issues, issues of war and foreign policy. We have an administration that is as right-wing as one could ever have imagined it being, and there they are. They're in power, and they control all three branches of our government. That's just not a happy situation, and we can sit out here and sort of complain about it. What we really need to do is get involved in thinking how we're going to change that at the next election for Congress in 04. It's going to be a really, really big issue. It's not a matter of having perfect people in Congress. I think it's worth saying anybody at this point would be better than Bush that might be elected, even perhaps Democrats, for all of their problems, if that's what it takes to get this bastard head of office.
Hear, hear.
Don't have too much to say to the questioner. I think he points out a problem that needs to be dealt with by all parties concerned. Brings to mind a video I saw, like, must be like 10 years ago at this point, Ted Turner's network when he was little station out of Atlanta, had this documentary called The Price of Peace. And the whole show was basically looking, well, what are you going to do with all these people who work in the tank factories and building the airplanes and are somehow, I mean, entire congressional districts are built on pork barrel money that goes into the military. There's no way they're going to, like, you know, it's political suicide to, like, say, even among union leadership, that's Bill Oakes' famous line, you know, the union leader screams when they close the missile plants. It's like, you know, you've got organized labor, you've got big business with the arms trade. What are you going to do with the people if you say, like, okay, we don't want you to build tanks anymore? How are you going to create some kind of alternative economy and either retrain, retool these factories to do something else? So it is a big question. It's a big issue, and it needs to be answered before we can just willy-nilly say, you know, unilateral, just like throw all these people out of work. Because what are we going to do? Just throw them on the welfare rolls? And you know, that's not a viable option. There have been plans put forward, and don't have the time to, like, really speak to that issue, which is beyond the terms of the debate here today. But it is a big issue that we all need to be thinking about, and especially...
Take a moment, sorry, with Robert, to just expand. I mean, I think you're making a really good point about
I think you make a really good point here about conversion issues, and if it's all right with Robert, I'd be happy to have you speak a little bit more on the topic you're talking about. I mean, how we would get to a politics that actually transforms what's going on so that we don't. I mean, we have been blackmailed, in effect. The Congress is blackmailed.
It's an important issue, but frankly, I'm trying to get at the local angle here.
Okay,
It is an important issue. I'd love to see Mike come back. Maybe you want to talk about that at another point or call in on that, or we can talk about that more. In response to the caller's question, when 11 of us went to Farr's office on Wednesday, and we were still unable to get from him a statement that he wanted to pull out the troops now, and that he was willing to call for stopping the bombing, and he wouldn't call for a ceasefire either at that time. And I don't know that he's changed his position. I called on Friday, and I didn't get any change in position from Rachel Dan, his staff member. One of the seven things we requested was supporting an excess war profits tax bill. I guess it's not the same as a war conversion, of course, but it's in the economic area anyway, as well as ceasefire and the bombing and the sanctions, declaring the war an illegal war, which Farr has done, supporting Beach impeachment or indictment proceedings, which Farr has not done. Actually, Farr, I think, has done one of the seven things we requested at that time. And I guess what I'm going to do now is ask both of you a question which I have... I've been concocting a few questions on the side here.
Surprise.
Believe it or not. The Santa Cruz City Council has taken a role of sorts in dealing with the Iraqi war, although, of course, it's been criticized by those on the right for dealing with non-local issues. There are some of us who have criticized it from the left for not dealing with this issue quickly enough, and also for essentially ducking strong statement on the issue, particularly recently. So, for instance, while there was a resolution that came up at the Santa Cruz City Council at the town hall meeting on Monday, which asked essentially for a statement that the troops should be withdrawn immediately, I think that was the Porter resolution, and then I think Councilmember Kennedy came back the next day with a second, more extensive resolution, which included that. The City Council had made no emergency finding to make an emergency resolution, which it could have done at the Tuesday Council session. There was a technicality that there was no notice of continuance from the Monday to the Tuesday session, but that wouldn't affect an emergency finding. That could have been done at any time. An old parliamentarian like Michael Rotkin knows all about those things. I'm wondering, originally on March 19th, there was a city council town hall scheduled that was postponed inexplicably for two more weeks. Santa Cruz led the city and the country in getting a city to come out with a resolution against the war, which encouraged 165 other cities to do the same in the Cities for Peace group and no preemptive strike. I'm going to ask the two of you to comment on City Council's failure to act in this matter. Now it's only going to act in 2 weeks, or I should say in a week and a half, Tuesday after next, when the whole issue won't be moot. But again, I think... Yeah. It'll be an occupation by that time, and I guess we'll still want the troops pulled out. But what is slowing down the City Council? Is it a concern for it can't be the concern for the sentiments of Farr, because they already had the resolution going. Why isn't the Council taking faster action? I'll ask you first, Mike, and then Joe, maybe you can respond if you want.
I don't think at this point, maybe I'm wrong, but I doubt that there's anybody in our community, and perhaps even beyond our community, that has any question about what the views of the Santa Cruz City Council and all seven of its members are about war with Iraq. I think at a certain point, you end up doing things that are not effective at actually building the kind of anti-war support that we need to build. And I wasn't at the meeting on Tuesday. My understanding was that at the town hall on Monday, I'm sorry. And my understanding is the reason they didn't vote was simply because they only had four members present and they were looking to actually get a unanimous vote of the council on the resolution. I helped write the resolution that Ed Porter presented. I doubt there's anybody on the council that disagrees with it. Scott Kennedy had suggested that it wasn't broad enough or that it didn't raise enough points, and so he was going to expand, I think, rather than oppose at least that's what I understand Ed Porter's motion. I think that the idea that somehow we have to spend all of our time every week dealing with this issue is a mistake. I think we have to maintain a certain credibility with the voters. We really aren't elected to deal primarily with national issues. I've been one of the main proponents of us taking up these kinds of national and international issues and speaking, in a sense, amplifying the voice of our residents on them. But I think we would really be perceived as not doing our jobs if we ended up taking a lot of time away from dealing with our pressing municipal issues to do more than the kinds of stuff we've done: take strong resolutions against the war, be the first city in the country to do it. And I don't, again, I don't think there's anybody in Santa Cruz that has any doubts about what our views are on this issue. From my point of view, it's we would better spend our time trying to bring other cities along with us, trying to take actions where we can help our citizens build an anti-war movement. And another resolution from us about the war at this time is not necessarily the most effective way, in my opinion, to build an anti-war movement. I would vote for such a resolution, even help bring one to the council, but it's not the most critical thing to be doing.
Joe Williams.
I'm all in favor of having the city council use its bully pulpit, if you will, to do actions and pass resolutions commenting on foreign policy. I think that is very appropriate because these issues are all essentially local issues. You know, we've got families with kids over there. We've got first responders being called up for the reserves and guard and being sent over to possibly, you know, kill and die on some foreign land. Yeah, exactly. It's our money that we pay. So it's, I think they have a rightful place to take positions on these issues. I'm all in favor of using, like, the quote-unquote Santa Cruz label to, like, actually get some national attention around this thing. Christopher Crone was a master of that in terms of, like, you know, using the Santa Cruz name to get out the opinions on issues of national importance, and I would hope that the council would continue to do that. Where it becomes problematic, at least in my opinion, I'm going to single out Mayor Riley here for her, I guess, support the Democrats at any cost, and I'm not sure of the rest of the council how they, you know, line up on this. But there was a town hall meeting, the first one at the Del Mar, where Farr had attacked the local media for not covering his press releases or whatever, and specifically singled out the four, you know, out-of-town-owned corporate daily newspapers here in this town. And what you want, and what happened, like, a couple weeks later, you read in the Metro, here's Mayor Riley kind of, like, you know, kind of sycophantically, you know, fawning over and covering up for Farr and saying, oh, he wasn't talking about the local media. He was talking about CNN and the national networks, which wasn't true. Anybody who was there, I heard him talk, heard the exchange with the daily newspapers. And so I think this kind of, you know, cover up for the Democrats by certain city council members is unconscionable and is not a proper way to approach things.
Thank you, Joe. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. If you have a question for Councilmember Rotkin or the infamous Joe Williams, please give a call, 427-3772. Looks like we got one coming in. Make your question 1 minute, please, or we will just cut you off. Oh, I love to cut people off. Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
This has been Mad John. I just wanted to correct something that one of the gentlemen said about Kucinich. He expressed his view that he has changed his view about pro-choice, and he is pro-choice. Now, of course, some people could say, well, that's just expedient politics.
John, let me interrupt you for a minute. We're really looking for a question here because we only have these guys in the studio. You can comment, like, in an hour or so. Colin will give you more time.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Try and do a question quickly.
Sure. Okay.
Is there a question you have, or...?
No, I just wanted to correct that.
Okay, sure.
Okay.
I'm happy to hear that. I need a mic here.
Okay, go ahead.
Go on, Robert.
We'll give you do it in a minute if you can, because it's not really a question. Go ahead.
15 seconds.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I'm happy to hear that if it's true, and I certainly wouldn't take the position that, you know, if he had an earlier view, you know, that I would hold that against him. If he's changed his view and willing to speak out and take that position of pro-choice, then I'm all for it and excited by it, and one more reason to think that he's an exciting candidate for the President of the United States.
Caller, you're on the air. You have a one-minute question for the callers.
Yes, I'd like to have both people respond whether they thought Neville Chamberlain was a good politician and did the right thing.
Sure. Although you want to be more specific, are you comparing peace movement with Neville Chamberlain, or?
Well, you see, I feel that the world should have stopped Adolf Hitler in Czechoslovakia.
And you feel that Hussein is similar.
What?
Saddam Hussein is similar in your view. Or was similar, if he's still around.
Well, I don't think he was quite as extreme, but what I want to find out is how far, adhere to nonviolence, and that's why I asked the question.
Okay, I'll put your question to him, caller.
Before we jump into this one, I just have a quick comment on the pro-choice thing. I wasn't aware of percentage changes in mine either, but I
he had made a change, a slight change, yeah.
Oh, well, that's fine. It's like I tend to agree with Mike on this. It's like, you know, if we're talking about issues of war and peace, then it's one thing. Other issues, you know, you discuss those, you know, separately. It's like one of the congressmen who voted against the use of force and, you know, and is Ron Paul of Texas, who's... is not pro-choice. He's pro-life. But he doesn't let that affect his, you know, voting in Congress. He's personally that way. So it's like, would we accept Ron Paul or invite him to the podium to speak against war? You bet. You bet. It's a non-issue in that respect. In terms of, like, I can only speak for, in terms of, like, non-violence, how far do you take it? As stated earlier, the Santa Cruz Peace Coalition does not have a non-violence code or a pacifist position that we take. I think, for me personally, self-defense is fine. Self-defense is fine, but if you're looking at issues of like Neville Chamberlain and Hitler, or versus, you know, whoever, you know, internationally, France, Germany, and Russia, you know, vis-a-vis Hussein, I think we're looking at issues where it's back to who's profiting, who arms these people, who supplies these people, and why do we only go after the purchasers of these supplies? It's like American corporations supplied Hitler. It's very, very documented. You know, Ford supplied, you know, Bush's grandfather, Prescott, supplied the Nazis with war material. I mean, this is documented stuff, so you have to go in and actually look at taking out the suppliers of this type of equipment, and we're back to, like, you know, who... You know, what kind of industries, what's the arms trade, what are the defense industries, or, you know, call them war industries, you know, forget the newspeak, and figure out who's arming these people. And is the same people who arm these people are the people we're going to entrust? It's like we've had the only democracies we've been able to establish that I can determine are Germany and Japan since World War II. Ever since then, we've kind of failed completely.
Mike. Oh, by the way, before you begin, Mike, caller, you're going to have to kind of keep hanging on the phone there because Mike's got 2 minutes to answer this if he wants to use the time.
I won't use the full 2 minutes because I agree with Joe in the comment. I also am not a pacifist, so it'd be, you know, you should ask a pacifist what their view would be about that question, and I could certainly, you know, build an argument about the question. But from my own view, the question is or was Saddam Hussein a threat to the United States of the kind that required a preemptive strike against him? And I think we have pretty clear evidence. Where are the weapons of mass destruction? Where are the chemical weapons, the biological weapons? None. The little flurry of attempts to find some from time to time. Believe me, if there had been any in the country, we would have found them by now. I don't rule out the possibility that once we have control of the ground there completely, we'll manufacture some evidence of weapons of mass destruction. I think our government is quite capable of doing that. We've demonstrated that over the years. But there's no evidence that he was a threat either to us or even the people in his own region in terms of military force. And as Joe said, the extent to which he was a threat was because the United States, Germany, and Russia and other countries armed the hell out of him in the first place. He would have been a small little petty dictator by himself with no threat even to his neighbors had we not turned him into a mega power in terms of the region. And in the end, after the years of sanctions by the UN and else and other stuff, he had basically been demobilized as a military threat to the region. So I don't think that the analogy works very well with Nazi Germany. I would have joined in the, I believe, of course it's easy to say at a distance, but I believe I would have supported World War II had I been, other than a little baby at the time, and would have gone to fight to stop Nazi Germany from imposing its will on the world. But that's a very different question than whether we're going to use the military power of the United States to go after every little dictator around the planet and kill the civilians in that country in order to get to them.
We have another caller coming in who's been patiently waiting. I have a question I want to ask, though, unfortunately, caller. maybe we can make this a real quick question, a 30-second answer, both of you. The Santa Cruz City Council has been criticized for doing a sort of a mini-Bush on Santa Cruz, that whereas we all oppose the military, we oppose Bush's foreign policy, we oppose the repression of the Patriot Act, the Santa Cruz City Council has fully funded the police department, it's passed new laws against poor and homeless people downtown, the downtown ordinances. There's been a perception, at least in some groups, that Santa Cruz City Council does locally what it opposes internationally. And I wonder if any of you, either of you want to comment on that in 30 seconds. Caller, stay on the line. We're going to put you next. Go ahead. If anybody wants to, I'm going to demand you two jump on that. Jump on that, you two.
Okay. The Peace Coalition has made numerous presentations in front of the City Council regarding issues around selective enforcement by the police, police harassment of various marginalized populations downtown. We have made presentations opposing the downtown ordinances. You know, so in terms of like where our position is, it's rather clear that there are some positions that city council has taken vis-a-vis the local population that we don't support either. But how this relates to foreign war, I'm not sure.
We'll find out. Go ahead.
Well, I would say this is a good example of the problem that I was talking about in my opening comment, which is trying to have a discussion about anti-war activities, try and build a broad coalition against the war, and then let's figure out, again, whether we disagree or agree with what the council's done, that somehow we're going to, like, hold the council accountable for that. Robert's done this a number of times, and he'll, of course, have a chance to defend himself. It's his show here, but gone to demonstrations about the war and used it as a forum for attacking the city council about its views about the homeless, which, whether correct or not, is not the forum or the appropriate place to do that kind of stuff. That's my view.
I wish we had more time to talk about that, but now we have a caller who's been waiting patiently. Here you go, caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Mike Rodkin and Joe Williams.
Hi, Robert?
Yes.
Yeah, it's Robert. There's a letter from Sam Farr in today's Monterey Herald.
Uh-huh.
That maybe you could read that and have...
Well, could you read it to us? Because we don't have a copy of the Herald here.
Oh, okay. Well, it's online.
Oh.
Is the one I'm looking at.
Well, do you want to read it to us?
Getting back to... Sam Farr.
Yeah, I mean, is it relevant to what we're talking about here?
Well, yeah, I mean, just in the fact that a lot of times we've been speculating about what his reasons for his votes are and,
okay.
You know, holding, you know, his reasons to,
Is it, how long is it?
It's fairly long. It's maybe probably about a 2-minute, I think.
Do it.
Or three.
I'm sure that the audience would be interested. Most of us don't get the Herald.
Okay, do you want to, I can give you the URL and you can read it.
Why don't you read it?
Okay. Right now?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Please.
Votes of conscience, patriotism. I deeply respect Herald letter writers who have chosen to share their views of the war in Iraq. It is a hallmark of our democracy that we are free to engage in this dialogue. By exercising this right to speech, we ensure that the freedoms we defend are real and not academic abstractions. I also have the highest respect and admiration for the women and men and women who serve in our military. As a member of the House Military Construction Appropriations Subcommittee, I've seen up close the skill and professionalism of our armed services. Quality of life for our military personnel is the primary responsibility of my subcommittee, and I am proud of the work we have done to increase the basic housing allowance, expand military child care facilities, and modernize and bring up to code existing military housing at the Presidio of Monterey. I have worked hard to improve the quality of life for our troops around the world and here at home at the DLI and the NPS. Because of the work I've done here in Congress, military service personnel in our region now have a top-notch veterans clinic and special rates at Black Horse and Bayonet golf courses. No one, hold on.
Go ahead.
No one can argue I haven't worked to improve our soldiers and our veterans' well-being. There can be no dispute that we owe our American troops a debt of gratitude and respect for winning the war. What I do not respect and what I cannot support is the president's policy that has led to this war. My recent votes concerning the war in Iraq reflect the distinction I have made between supporting the troops on the ground and dissenting with a foreign policy run amok. In doing so, I have made the only decisions my conscience could allow, starting with my no vote last October on the Iraq use of force legislation, and most recently voting no on the emergency wartime supplemental appropriations bill. These votes haven't been about the troops. They have been about the administration's policy and its failed diplomacy that dragged us into war. The president has never committed to resolving the crisis with Iraq through peaceful negotiation. From the beginning, he spoke of regime change in Iraq. He came before the United Nations to silence critics, not out of sincere respect for the institution. The same is true of the president's attitude toward Congress. International organizations and the legislative branch of the U.S. government have been merely hurdles between the president and his ultimate goal, the overthrow of the Iraqi regime. These votes are not about international law, democracy, or human rights. They are about combating this administration's dangerous unilateral policy. Nevertheless, these recent votes, the misleadingly named Support Our Troops resolution, and the emergency supplemental appropriations for the war, were difficult votes to take. I would have gladly voted to express support for the American men and women in Iraq. Regrettably, the Republican congressional leadership gave us a resolution that vindicated every aspect of the president's policy. It mentioned support of the troops almost as an afterthought. I voted present, an expression of my displeasure at this partisan statement in support for the war and the unprecedented preemptive policy that got us there. On the emergency wartime supplemental funding bill, I voted no. This bill skimped on funding for Homeland Security, did not address the crumbling relations between the U.S. and the international community, and failed to provide for post-conflict reconstruction. I also object to the lack of information regarding the full cost of this war and the cuts to the domestic programs which the President has yet to articulate. When President Kennedy asked what I could do for my country, I served 2 years in the Peace Corps in Colombia. I have dedicated my life to public service. It is my honor to serve today in the People's House here in Congress. In every decision I make, I weigh the interests and opinions of the citizens in this district, as well as the well-being of the more than 1,200 Central Coast residents in Iraq right now. Disagreements over votes notwithstanding, I know we are all united in support of restoring confidence in the American people and their shared desire for peace on earth. Sam Farr, D. Carmel, blah, blah, blah.
I commend you on having read through that.
Yeah, it was pretty long. Sorry.
No, it's good. Do you have a quick question, or should we just get comments on
it? No, this one's like, maybe they could, because we've been speculating on what his intentions are and blah, blah.
Right.
You know, there's something that he said, so right. They can maybe comment on that.
Sure. Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Okay.
Well, my first reaction, I mean, I'm definitely going to go home and get a copy of that. It sounds like more of the same old from Farr. It's like, you know, after stating like, oh, look how anti-war I am, then he winds up turning around and saying, look at all the great things I've done for the troops. And it basically, you know, all these things that enable the U.S., enable this administration, as he, you know, keeps pointing out, and it's not just the administration, it's the Congress, it's his party that he's part of, that he refuses to, like, lob any criticism at whatsoever, I find problematic. But the fact that all this types of stuff he's doing, oh, look at how great I am for the troops around the world. You know, they even have golf course privileges. Oh, look what a great guy I am. You know, he keeps pointing out this administration, the president's policy. I think this is part of it. It's like, what do we do now, Sam? What is next? I think he's run out of ideas. All he is doing now is trying to, like, pat himself on the back for a couple tepid votes that entailed no political risk to him at all in a safe political district. This thing about the Peace Corps in Colombia, I just find completely, you know, considering, like, you know, what he's voted for down there and supporting the slaughter of, you know, union leaders and indigenous peasants down there. Don't support that at all. What's time left on this?
About 45 seconds.
45 seconds. It's back to the issue of, like, what do we expect Sam to do at this point? It's like, he's made statements like, I don't support civil disobedience. I don't support the pullout of the troops. I don't support impeachment of Bush. The debate on whether to send the troops is over. So he's kind of staked out a position like, this is as far as I'm going to go. So, you know, where are we left in terms of, like, wanting him to take a stand on something? I think we're going to have him make a stand within his own party and start some criticism of his fellow Democrats and quit, like, blaming the administration when it was a party that he's a member of that granted this authorization, you know, for this thing. And also, you look at his website, and it's not got anything about peace on it. It's got links, support the troops, support the families, yada, yada, yada. He's got 6 pages of links on how you can support the troops, and I want 6 pages of links on how we can support the peace movement.
Mike Redkin. A caller, hang in there. You're going to be next. Go ahead.
I think that the letter is actually a perfectly good letter. I think what it does is provide the necessary cover that not only Sam Farr, but that the peace movement needs to develop around making very, very clear that the opponent, that what we oppose is not the individual American soldiers, that we're not hoping that these people all die or that they have horrible things happen to them or that they somehow are the problem or that we should starve them out or that somehow we would change if we had inadequate housing and veterans, the stuff that the Bush administration seems to take the position on, which is, you know, if we don't give our veterans decent medical care when they return from conflict, or that if we don't provide people with them with decent housing for their families, or that they don't deserve decent pay while they're doing this work, that somehow that's going to make peace happen. Peace is about a foreign policy issue, and it's not about providing reasonable kinds of support, material support, for the people that serve in the military. And the peace movement is going to have to discover that, as we did in the war in Vietnam and the anti-war movement there, that we have to work very, very hard. If you're going to build a majority anti-war movement, it's not going to be built on the basis of let's attack the soldiers and the whether it's golf course privileges, for God's sake, which is, of course, absurd. The issue is,
Sam is trying to make very clear that his opponent here is not the individual children of the people in Monterey County, which is what the letter's talking about, that are serving in the military. The opposition is against our foreign policy, the Bush administration, and the people that are making this. Does anybody think that Al Gore would have had us attacking every international institution and going after the UN the way the Bush administration has done it? I think not. I think that's the issue here.
Thank you, Mike. Now we have a caller. Caller, what's your question? You're on the air.
Hello? Hi, Robert.
Hi.
This is Roxanne.
Hey, Roxanne.
I wanted to comment to a couple things, but I don't know if I'm being timed, so...
You are being timed. You have a minute to give a question, and if for longer comments, you can call back like in about half an hour talk more.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just want to say that when you were bringing up your inappropriate questions about city council, that almost everybody understands that they need to be the change they want to see. And so as it lacks credibility when a group of people who are doing the same things locally go up against a regime.
Roxanne, ask him a question because I want to hear more what you have to say later. But
well, that was the question. I want to know from Mike, and actually even from Joe, how these things are inappropriate when brought up at peace demonstrations, because we need the same kind of
5 seconds
peace here in Santa Cruz. We need the same kind of treatment as Iraq needs. That's it.
All right. Let's see what the answer is. Thanks, Roxanne. Call back, please. Go ahead. Go ahead, Mike.
Thanks for calling in. I think the question comes down to whether people believe that what we're doing in Santa Cruz in terms of the downtown ordinances or other kinds of issues is in fact the same as or in some way part of or non-distinguishable from what's going on in Iraq. My view is that the ordinances downtown and the way, even including the way that they're enforced, is not, it's of course nobody's claiming that we're killing anybody in downtown Santa Cruz, but that we're even repressing people is not my view of what's happening overall. I'm not saying there's never any individual abuses by particular officers or problems that happen, but overall I think the vast majority of people who were, for example, at that rally of 7,000 people against the war do not believe that somehow the Santa Cruz police are involved in major repression of people in our downtown community, so that we have different views about what's actually going on down there. And the reason it's inappropriate to bring in the discussion is not because you can't say what you think, but there's not time to get into the details of a discussion about that topic, which could happen some other time. I've been on the radio with Robert.
Your time is up.
Then I'm done.
I love it.
Then I'm done.
I wish you could talk more about it, though. Go ahead, Joe.
I don't really have much to say on this topic. Perception, I mean, perhaps we can get together and talk about the city council and some of what the members of the Peace Coalition consider extremely bad repressive legislation locally. How this ties into the larger anti-war movement, I think, you know, a connection can be made in terms of if you, you know, look at how it ties into the larger picture. But once again, it's like I'm happy to have the city councils, you know, passing these resolutions, you know, against this war, against any war. And I think that if they're going to entertain a resolution that support bringing the troops home, that condemn an adventuristic foreign policy by our national administration and Congress, by the way, Mr. Farr, and the Democratic Party, by the way, Mr. Farr, on and on, I think they deserve support for that. And, you know, mixing up the issues, yes, it's the same kind of thing with Farr. It's like support them when they're right, hold them accountable when they're wrong, and push them to take more progressive stances on issues, whether locally or nationally.
Okay, so you're surrendering the last minute of your statement.
Well, sure.
Okay.
It looked like a phone call was ringing, so if the caller wants to call back, I would encourage...
We actually have a new face in the studio, or it's actually an old face. Steve Argue, and Steve, you had an exchange with Councilmember Rotkin on the Internet about the issue of the Peace Coalition. In fact, we mentioned in the last sentence of your letter you were concerned about the credibility of Mr. Argue's opinion around the issue of the war. But you have a question, because you've got a minute to pose a question to these two, which they might be willing to answer on the issue. Here, you can use my mic. It's okay. Any question you have, Steve, or are you just going to comment later on it?
Yeah, let me comment later. I just rolled in. I'm kind of winded from the bike.
All right, so no problem. Okay, well then, good. This gives me a chance to throw another question. Unless somebody wants to call in real quick and zip out a question for these two, I'll keep my eye on the phone light. Okay, well, that's the question. What now is the question for me, for from you two? What can be done now, now that FAR continues to... and we're talking about FAR here. I mean, obviously, there are many things that could be done more broadly with the peace movement, but FAR himself has refused to take an out-now position and to do six of the seven things that the activists who came to his office 4 days ago asked him to do. What can we do now, and has... I'll make it a double question. Has the pressure on FAR been effective, in your view, or has it been more sectarian and made him and alienated him? What has been the effect of, let's say, the threat to do a sit-in in his office, as we did in Kosovo matter back in 1999? Joe, go ahead.
I think it's hard to gauge, you know, what kind of, you know, what's influenced him to make the decisions. Personally, I would like to think that, yeah, you know, things like knowing that there's going to be consequences to him not adequately reflecting his constituents' views on issues of war and peace will have consequences, such as not being able to speak at peace rallies and things like that. I think those are the kind of things that encourage him to, like, oh, well, there's going to be consequences for me not taking a stand that represents my constituents' views. So I would like to think that, yes, it has. Whether or not it does, I don't know. In terms of what he says, you know, who knows? He's in a safe district. He can run around naked and make peace signs in the snow, you know, urinate, you know, whatever, and he'd still get reelected. So in terms of, like, you know, what's gonna compel him to take a stronger stand on some of these issues, I'm not quite sure. At this point, I think he's kind of played out. You know, the letters, you know, that was read by Rachel Dan at the town hall meeting, in terms of, like, the letter that was just read from the Monterey Herald, he's not coming in with any new ideas. He's not echoing Denis Kucinich's calls for, you know, withdrawal or ceasefire or anything. He's just saying, this is why I voted, and now it's up to all of us to support the troops around the world. And it's like, well, support the troops around the world by getting their butts back home. You know, it's like, I'm much more willing to, like, support right-wing Republicans like Ron Paul and, you know, Pat Buchanan, because at least they're honest about their, like, isolationist positions. Processes at the local colleges. We disrupt the recruiting center in Capitola. We make it hard for them to, like, you know, get bodies to wage these wars. We take on corporations like Lockheed Martin locally, and we need to shut them down and get them out of the county. We do tax resistance. There's a variety of things that Sam Farr is useless for.
Thank you. Mike Watkins.
My view is that where the peace movement needs to go next, and to relate this particularly to Sam Farr, is I think we need to build, through public education, a sense that the majority of people in this community believe that we should not be occupiers in Iraq. I think that's the next issue for us, and that that Iraq needs to be rebuilt, a combination of their own internal forces, which will be difficult because of the mess that's been made there, starting with Britain back at the turn, you know, a century ago. But beyond that, the mess that we've made there as well, and the combination of the local forces there and United Nations support, not unilateral U.S. or British and U.S. Imposition of an imperialist relationship with the country. And I don't think the majority of people in our community have strong views about that issue, understand the implications of this. There are some people that get it, others that don't. We have an education job to pull off, and I think if we educate our community about that issue adequately, and that's not by going after Sam Farr, and that's not by direct sit-ins initially and so forth, but that's by putting out literature, by explaining the politics of this, by letters to the editor, again, reaching broad-based ways to educate people about these issues, that'll be the most effective. I think once we have those kinds of views in our community, and we know that that is the majority view, and I'm not sure that it is right now, that we would then be an appropriate place to begin taking direct actions of the kinds that Joe's suggesting, and I support those. Nonviolent, direct civil disobedience actions, which punctuate the strong views about this. But those kinds of actions taken in isolation of a clear majority view in the community are not very effective. People are seen as out of step with what's going on. So I think our main job now is educational. I think we really have to do a lot of hard work, door-to-door work, build the kind of movement that actually speaks to the citizens in this community, not just talk to ourselves in a kind of a sectarian fashion. And I think that's really, really critical. If we're serious about not having an imperialist relationship with Iraq and the rest of the Middle East forever, we need to start getting our citizens involved in understanding what's going on, and that requires us to do some hard educational work.
Thank you, Mike. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is a debate on Sam Farr, bane or boon to the peace movement. In another sense, which way do we go now in Santa Cruz with the peace movement? You're listening to Joe Williams and Mike Rotkin. And Mike, you say you have about 5 minutes left? So if anybody has any questions, they better call in real fast, because Rotkin is hightailing it out of here. And what we may do here is give both these...
You should point out to your listeners that Joe's just pulled off his outer shirt and he's wearing a T-shirt that says sectarian idiot on it, which I have to say shows a great sense of humor.
I see. Well, we want to get a picture of
once
this.
Once again, I do need to apologize to Joe for having used that comment in the newspaper. Anyway, that's funny, Joe. It's good work.
So we have sectarian idiot, and Mike has a T-shirt, soldiers risk their lives for war. What are you willing to risk for peace? Perhaps an emergency session of the city council to quickly vote on the issue, Mike? Well,
yeah. That
would be nice. I don't think I really got an answer to the question, why didn't the city council act on this issue? Why didn't you raise it at the last council meeting? But sometimes I don't get answers to my questions.